From the Voice of America in Washington, this is VOA Global. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson. You know, each and every day we produce a lot of great things here at VOA. We thought we'd give you some of that all in one spot right here on VOA Today. First up is Daybreak Asia, where the earthquake rescue and relief efforts are slowly getting into Nepal. Women's rights are the focus of the United Nations and Francis Alonso's Women Rising. Sarah Williams in China Focus take in the latest on Hong Kong politics. The normal formula for learning is reversed in the American Cafe with Ira Melman. A self-powered camera catches David Byrd in its viewfinder. That's on today's edition of Now. Paul McCartney has been playing music and touring since he was a teenager. Steve Norman's been listening since he was a teen. He and the former Beatle team up in our music feature. That and much more on today's VOA Global. This is Daybreak Asia, a summary of Asian news and events for Tuesday, April 28th. I'm Jim Stevenson. Hello and welcome. Among today's headlines in Nepal, hopes of finding survivors are fading as the tiny country struggles to cope with the aftermath of the huge earthquake that struck it, claiming more than 3,700 lives, and that figure is rising. Anjana Pasricha reports rescue teams are scrambling to reach those who need aid amid looming fears of epidemics and mounting shortages of food and water.
More than 48 hours after the magnitude 7.8 earthquake shook Nepal, distraught people prayed and waited to get some news of their loved ones as rescuers used everything from pickaxes to bare hands to sift the rubble. A young couple in Kathmandu related to reporters how they were out of the house when the earthquake buried their home on Saturday. On Monday, there was still no news of the two young children they had left behind. But the father waits patiently on mounds of rubble. He says he wants to find his children, dead or alive. He says even that has not been possible. Nepal's capital and other towns all have such heart-wrenching stories. Mass cremations were conducted on Monday as the death toll continued to rise. Relief efforts slowly picked up pace after the killer quake and powerful aftershocks left tens of thousands homeless. It is the worst disaster in living memory for most Nepalese. Nepal's chief secretary, Lila Mani Podiyal, appealed again for urgent help from the international community, saying they need everything from dry goods to tents and paramedics to expert teams to cope with the aftermath. Huge tented camps are springing up in the main towns, but similar assistance has yet to reach remote areas. Neighboring India has been able to swiftly send the Indian military and disaster personnel to assist the rescue and relief effort, but it has not been easy for other international teams to land in Nepal due to the chaos and congestion at the country's small and only international airport. India's Foreign Secretary Subramaniam Jaishankar spoke of heavy traffic on highways leading to Kathmandu.
To the best of our information, the roads are open, but the traffic is moving very slowly. It's clogged with vehicles. We are trying to piece together a picture, but it's a very, very difficult situation.
The mounting shortages are a challenge for the tens of thousands who fled their homes without money or clothes. There are snaking lines outside fuel stations. Drinking water is in short supply and food prices are climbing in the landlocked country, which trucks in most of its supplies from India. An Indian woman who managed to get out of the Nepalese capital says it is hard to watch the poor nation's distress. She says there is very little help available. All the people are on the road. All of Kathmandu is on the road. The United Nations Children's Emergency Fund says nearly a million children are in urgent need of humanitarian assistance. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
Congestion in the airspace over Nepal and on the ground at Kathmandu's airport is preventing critically needed relief supplies and rescue personnel from reaching areas stricken by Saturday's magnitude 7.8 earthquake in the landlocked Himalayan nation. VOA correspondent Steve Herman on Thai Airways Flight 319 at Calcutta International Airport has details.
The 70-person search and rescue team of Japan had hoped to reach Kathmandu midday Monday after flying in from Tokyo. But the Thai Airways flight from Bangkok to Nepal's capital, also carrying aid workers and journalists from numerous countries, never made it. After circling south of Kathmandu numerous times, The air traffic controllers told Flight 319 there was no space at the airport. The captain, worried about the amount of remaining fuel, decided to divert to Calcutta to refuel. A second attempt to reach Kathmandu from Calcutta also did not succeed. The Indian Air Force also had to turn back some of its cargo planes to Kathmandu, carrying critical supplies. Steve Herman, VOA News, aboard Thai Flight 319 at Calcutta International Airport.
Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe is in Boston at the start of a four-city U.S. visit. That's including talks with U.S. President Barack Obama at the White House later today and an unprecedented address to a joint meeting of Congress Wednesday. VOA's Victor Beatty reports the visit comes on the 70th anniversary of the end of World War II. It underscores the changing security and economic relationship between the United States and Japan.
Mr. Abe's visit takes place as senior U.S. and Japanese officials unveil updated defense guidelines reflecting Japan's greater role in its own defense. U.S. National Security Asian Affairs Director Evan Medeiros said Friday the revision, the first since 1997, will significantly expand Japan's role in the alliance and provide a mechanism for Japan to provide a wider range of support to U.S. forces. Japan's U.S. Ambassador Kenichiro Sasai told the Centers for Strategic and International Studies the new guidelines will be followed by security legislation in line with last year's cabinet decision to change the interpretation of Japan's post-war constitution to allow it to engage in collective self-defense operations.
For Japan, this change in our thinking on collective defense is a sea change. It is coming after 70 years of trust, and the legislations will establish a framework for Japan to further collaborate with the United States.
Temple University Asian Studies Professor Jeffrey Kingston in Tokyo calls Mr. Abe's new proactive pacifism initiative a massive transformation in Japan's security policy and says a rising China is driving this change.
Back in 1997, China's defense budget was $10 billion. Last year, it was $144 billion, and there's been a lot of saber-rattling over disputed territories between two countries. The rising China narrative and concerns about its hegemonic ambitions in Asia are pushing the United States and Japan closer.
But Kingston says domestic support for the proactive pacifism policy is weak, with only 23% public approval against 68% opposition. He says the new defense guidelines could commit Japan to more than the parliament and the public support, and that could cause bilateral tensions. Kingston says Mr. Abe's negotiations with the U.S. on the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement involving 10 other Pacific nations hold both economic and geopolitical importance for Japan. Meanwhile, the New York Times quotes Japanese journalists and political experts as saying the Abe government is using a carrot-and-stick approach to try to silence domestic critics of Mr. Abe's policies. The Times says it has a chilling effect on coverage at a time when Mr. Abe is pushing ahead with a conservative agenda to dismantle the nation's post-war pacifist consensus and put forth more positive portrayals of Japan's World War II-era behavior. Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
I'm Jim Stevenson. Daybreak Asia is a weekday feature of VOA. Be sure to follow the latest on the Nepal earthquake at our website, voanews.com, along with other news from Asia. Our Daybreak Asia podcast is also there. Subscribe to it so you can be sure to hear it each and every day. As we tell you each and every day, we enjoy reading your comments that you leave for us on all the stories that we post on our website at voanews.com. One of the more unusual postings we have up on our website is in response to the Nepal earthquake and how to donate to relief efforts. Countries and charities worldwide have begun a massive international aid operation in Nepal, where that powerful earthquake and numerous aftershocks have killed thousands. Saturday's quake was most severely felt in the capital as well as in the densely populated Kathmandu Valley. But the entire country is feeling its effects. Governments, including the United States, China, Germany, and Israel, are sending medical and search and rescue teams, as well as providing food and medical supply aid. For individuals, The best ways to donate are to focus on charities that already have a presence on the ground. And we do have links on our website at voanews.com for ways that you can send your charity and aid if you wish to do so. Trade Council responded to our story and posted the International Trade Council has launched an infrastructure relief program to provide electricity, sanitation, water, and other equipment needs. And they provide a link to their website as well. That's all on voanews.com. Another story that we had posted that garnered some interesting comments. Leaders from the Association of the Southeast Asian Nations meeting in Malaysia have called for a peaceful settlement of competing territorial claims in the South China Sea. Sensei wrote to us, he said the U.S. never ratified the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea. I guess they don't want to be bound by international law like the Chinese target they wish to contain with their pivot to Asia. An interesting take. You can add yours as well at voanews.com. This is VOA Global on the Voice of America. We're glad to have you with us today. Don't forget, you can follow us on Twitter and Facebook. We really like our Facebook page. It's called VOA Asia. Stop by where you can read many of the stories that we've posted on our website and a few other things that we've also put up there for your enjoyment. Photos, videos, it's all there. VOA Asia Facebook. And while you're there, we hope that you'll like us.
Welcome to this edition of Voice of America's Women Rising. I'm your host, Frances Alonzo. UN Women has just released a new report that outlines what the organization considers a far-reaching policy agenda to advance women's rights titled Progress of the World's Women 2015-2016, Transforming Economies, Realizing Rights. I spoke to Laura Touquet, the report's manager for UN Women. She says the report gives an overview of what the economy would look like if it truly worked for women for the benefit of all.
The agenda that we're advocating for is an agenda that brings together the need for decent work, so not only more jobs, but better quality jobs for women. Social policy that works for women. So here we're talking about things like family allowances and pensions, as well as social services like healthcare and childcare. We also need an enabling economic environment, one where economic policies raise the kind of resources that we need in order to fund the kind of social policies we want to see, and an economic environment where the generation of decent work is prioritized. Elements of this agenda that are being implemented in all regions of the world. You know, no country in the world has reached gender equality, but there are lots of countries that are implementing different aspects of this agenda. So, for example, when we look at decent work, many countries now are using minimum wages to make sure to lift the floor of wages for women, and these are shown to have an impact on the gender pay gap. When we take something like healthcare, many women, especially in rural areas, have problems accessing healthcare services because they're too far away from where they live. So we're asking for a new economic agenda which brings together these three areas: decent work, public services, and economic policies. But I think it's clear that there are many countries that are already taking steps in the right direction.
When this report is presented, what response are you expecting?
I think we're hoping that the report will be used by a very broad set of audiences. You know, we would love ministers of finance to use the report to pick up its findings and implement its recommendations. You know, we're hoping that the report will be used by policymakers, by women's organizations, by trade unions, and by other organizations that are joining with us to help bring about change.
Tell me about South Asia. How did women fare in South Asia?
In this report, we've calculated the global gender pay gap, which is 24%. But at regional level, it can be even higher than that. So in South Asia, for example, women are on average paid 33% less than men. So I think what we're seeing is, although we have more, in some countries, more women in paid employment, they're often in, you know, low-paid, poor-quality jobs, which make it very difficult for them to work their way out of poverty.
You mentioned the jobs. What are women particularly clustered around a certain set of jobs? What did the study find?
Yeah, I mean, there's a big problem with occupational segregation, which happens in all countries, actually, rich and poor countries alike. You tend to have women clustered in a very limited set of undervalued occupations. And one of the clearest examples is domestic work, which is a huge and growing occupation. There are 53 million domestic workers in the world. 83% of them are women. This is work that often is carried out behind closed doors. It's often not covered by labor laws. It's often not covered by minimum wage legislation. And these workers are undervalued and tend to be subject to abuse and exploitation. But there are a number of countries that are taking very positive steps to protect the rights of these workers by ensuring that they can access minimum wages, that they have time off, for maternity leave, that they have, you know, at least one day off a week. So there are a number of countries, you know, from Uruguay to the Philippines to Brazil to South Africa that are taking the right steps to protect those workers' rights.
So now, Laura, tell me about what is the major takeaway in your mind for women in particular, not just, you know, governments and policies and organizations. What would be her takeaway from this report?
When women come together to demand change, they can be among the most effective drivers of change. So, you know, in countries where you have strong women's movements who have been lobbying for change, you see a lot of changes in the law and you see a lot of positive change in favor of women's rights. So I think it's about getting informed, finding out the ways in which women are still not equal to men, joining up with other women, joining women's organizations, and, you know, lobbying for change, demanding that our human rights are fulfilled.
That's Laura Turquet, the report's manager for UN Women. To read the report, visit progress.unwomen.org. I'm Frances Alonzo. Thank you for joining me on Women Rising.
I'm Sarah Williams with China Focus. Last week, Hong Kong's pro-Beijing government unveiled a set of electoral reform proposals. For the first time, the plan would allow the Chinese territory to elect its leader in 2017. But it also complies with Beijing's demand that all candidates for the top leadership be approved by a pro-China nominating committee. Hong Kong Chief Executive CY Leung defended the plan. He said this proposal meets the demands of the majority of the Hong Kong population. But Alan Leung, a pro-democracy lawmaker, condemned the procedure. He said the proposal allows a small circle to control the election result by controlling the nomination process. Jacques Delisle is a professor of law and political science at the University of Pennsylvania and an expert on Chinese law and politics.
There's really almost nothing in here that departs from what came out in the August 31st document from Beijing, from the National People's Congress Standing Committee. The thing that's being pointed to as the biggest move toward the Democrats' demands is lowering the threshold for the number of members of this nominating committee, this 1,200-person, largely pro-Beijing nominating committee. You'll only need 120 rather than 150 of them to support you, to get you into the pool from whom the three candidates, or perhaps as few as two candidates, that will be in the general election will be chosen. So that's a very, very small concession. And it's not even clear that that's much of a concession because the 150 number is simply what it was last time around.
So where does this whole process go now? Yeah, and what can, say, the pro-democracy supporters, both within the legislature and outside, what options do they have for them? Or do they have any?
Well, they do have options. One of the things about Hong Kong is for all of the complaints about the lack of democracy built into this election. And again, it will be a universal suffrage election. Everybody in Hong Kong will be able to vote for the two or three candidates who are put forward. The complaint is really about the process for selecting those candidates. And that is a matter of Hong Kong election law. So although we have what one might very well call a democratic deficit in Hong Kong, it is a place that does have a constitutional structure to it. And the arrangement now is that the new election laws, whatever the rules are going to be for nominating and then electing the next chief executive in 2017, those laws have to be passed through the Legislative Council. And they have to receive support from two-thirds of the members of the Legislative Council. There are 70 members. 27 of them are usually called pan-dems. They're basically members of the pro-democracy camp. You do the math, that's more than one-third. They can block the legislation if they hang together. Now, it's a costly move, potentially, and they're going to be under a lot of political pressure, because if they reject the government's proposal for the rules for the next chief executive election, then the understanding is that we're not going to be able to get a different bill through, so it will revert to the current rules under which the chief executive is chosen not by any vote in Hong Kong, but by the decision of essentially the same body that would be the nominating body under the proposed rules, the group of 1,200 people who are pretty strongly pro-Beijing.
And what about the possibility of further protests? Certainly Hong Kong received a tremendous amount of international attention when so many people took to the streets to protest last year.
I wouldn't be surprised to see protests. I mean, we've already seen signs that the government is putting a lot of pressure on the more moderate or more middle-of-the-road pan-democratic legislators to accept the proposal and go for it, because otherwise, in the government's view, they can be blamed for impeding small steps toward democracy. Well, when you've got that kind of pressure coming from the government, you're going to get counter-pressure from the pro-democracy groups in society, and then counter-counter-pressure from social groups who are more pro-Beijing. So I wouldn't be at all surprised to see a protest. Now, the protests are a little bit tricky, because on the one hand, the protests were really quite effective last time. They obviously petered out in the end. But I think one of the hopeful prospects for protesters going forward was that there would be another day to fight. And this is that other day. That is, they will mobilize to address the pending legislation and to try to stiffen the resolve of any wavering pro-democracy or pandem legislators. On the other hand, as we also saw with the October protests, at some point, if they are disrupting traffic, if they are disrupting life in Hong Kong, if they are doing the kind of things that get them attention locally and from the international media, there comes a point where public opinion may turn somewhat against them. People get weary of the disruptions, and I think some people think it's ultimately futile because the decisions here aren't really in the control of people in Hong Kong or even of the Hong Kong government.
Follow us on Weibo. That's China Focus. I'm Sarah Williams.
From the Voice of America, I'm Jim Stevenson with Asia Business News. Japanese stocks edged down Monday in subdued trade as investors were cautious amid the earnings season and ahead of some key events later this week, including central bank meetings in Japan and the United States. The Nikkei share average ended 0.2% lower to close at 19,983. Hong Kong stocks, meanwhile, advanced to fresh seven-year highs, led by Chinese state-owned giants on expectations that Beijing will accelerate mergers among state-owned enterprises, or SOEs. China will likely cut the number of its central government-owned conglomerates to 40 through massive mergers, as Beijing looks to overhaul the vast underperforming state sector, that according to state media reports. Currently, there are 112 SOEs controlled by the central government. The Hang Seng Index rose 1.3% to 28,433. The China Enterprises Index also gaining 1.7%. It now sits at 14,741. A move by British banking giant HSBC to relocate its headquarters back to Hong Kong would present major challenges to that city's banking watchdog, according to regulatory experts. The Hong Kong Monetary Authority is regarded as one of Asia's leading regulators and has experience with subsidiaries and branches of large banks, but it has never been the primary regulator of a systematically important global financial institution. HSBC's $2.6 trillion balance sheet is nearly eight times the size of Hong Kong's economic output, and so the HKMA would have to scale up its regulatory operations, according to analysts and regulatory experts. HSBC said Friday it had ordered a review into whether it should move its headquarters out of Britain and potentially back to Hong Kong. That's a look at Asia Business News on VOA.
This is Today in History. On April 28, 1758, James Monroe, the fifth U.S. president, was born. Monroe is best known for the doctrine that bears his name. It discouraged European interference in the Western Hemisphere, seeking to avoid any attempts to make the New World a battleground for Old World nations. On April 28, 1881, U.S. outlaw and folk hero William H. Bonney, better known as Billy the Kid, escaped from a courthouse jail in New Mexico. The Kid had been awaiting execution, having been found guilty of murder. 3 months later, the icon of the American Wild West was shot and killed by a sheriff. In 1908, ethnic German businessman Oskar Schindler was born in what is now the Czech Republic. Schindler saved the lives of hundreds of his Jewish factory workers during World War II. His efforts are recounted in the book and movie Schindler's List. In 1937, Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein was born, leading his country into two devastating wars. Saddam's nearly 25-year rule was characterized by brutal suppression of internal dissent. He was overthrown in the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq in 2003. He was captured later that year, tried, and later executed. In 1945, Italian communist partisans executed former dictator Benito Mussolini and his mistress as the fascist leader attempted to flee to Switzerland near the close of World War II.
On this day in 1969, Charles de Gaulle resigned as president of France after his proposals for constitutional reform were defeated in a national referendum. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
You're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. Coming up, some planes carrying earthquake aid for Nepal arrive in Kathmandu, but others are turned away. We'll have a report from New York on how the earthquake has shaken the city's Nepalese community, and we'll take you to a Kenyan refugee camp where Somali refugees face an imminent deadline to return home. I'm Michael Lippin. Nepalese authorities have carried out a mass cremation of earthquake victims as international humanitarian teams arrive in the capital Kathmandu to help survivors of Saturday's disaster. The death toll has climbed to more than 4,000. Hospitals in Kathmandu were overwhelmed with thousands of injured. Humanitarian workers said landslides and rubble were blocking them from delivering aid to more remote communities outside the capital. Some planes carrying additional relief workers and supplies were turned back from the overwhelmed Kathmandu airport on Monday, while others were able to offload cargo before evacuating the injured. Communications remained cut off in some of those remote areas, raising concerns that the number of casualties will rise significantly. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says the United States is providing another $9 million in aid for Nepal. Washington's total aid pledges have now reached $10 million, with more expected to come. The U.S. Agency for International Development said in a statement that the money will be used to help Nepal with search and rescue efforts and providing emergency shelter, clean water, and sanitation. Well, here in the United States, the Nepalese earthquake has had a deep psychological impact on New York City's Sherpa community. Most of the 5,000 or so Sherpas in New York originally came from Kathmandu and rural areas hard hit by the quake. VOA's Adam Phillips reports on how they're coping with the disaster.
The ornate multicolored Buddhist temple in Jackson Heights, Queens, which serves as headquarters for the United Sherpa Association and as spiritual center for this community, resounded with bells and chants on Sunday as the community came to grips with the devastating news from the homeland in a candlelight puja ceremony. Community member Ong Nyangwang Sherpa, a taxi driver, said he was comforted by the ritual. But until earlier this morning, he was unable to reach his loved ones in the capital by phone or email.
It's so difficult. We can't sleep and we can't concentrate in our job. We are really in a shock and we can't, really do much other than pray, and any kind of help is greatly appreciated.
Temple photographer Ankami Sherpa says the United Sherpa Association has raised nearly $17,000 in cash so far, but that getting that relief money to the people who need it poses its own challenges.
We are trying to fundraise some money that we just try to send there to Nepal. But, in our country, governments are not so good. We don't trust government people. Sometimes they're not honest.
Meanwhile, the Sherpas of New York and the rest of the world continue to watch and wait for further news out of Nepal. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
In the eastern U.S. city of Baltimore, street riots erupted on Monday after the funeral of a black man who died from an injury sustained while in police custody earlier this month. A Baltimore police official said at least seven officers were wounded in clashes with hundreds of youths who pelted them with rocks, bricks, glass bottles, and other objects. The officers responded with pepper spray to keep the protesters back. Television footage showed at least one police vehicle in flames and crowds of looters breaking into stores. Earlier in the day, thousands of mourners gathered at a Baltimore church to pay their respects to 25-year-old Freddie Gray. Among those attending Gray's funeral was U.S. civil rights activist Reverend Jesse Jackson.
We're here because we feel threatened. All of our sons are at risk. There's too much killing, too much hatred, too much violence, too much fear. In this community, he is more than a citizen. He's a martyr.
Well, Gray suffered severe spinal cord injuries following his arrest on April 12th. Officials said Gray was not restrained properly while being transported in a police van. His death is the latest in a series of incidents sparking U.S. street protests about perceived excessive use of force by police against minorities. The Obama administration is defending the terms of its tentative deal with Iran to restrain the Iranian nuclear program. U.S. Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs Wendy Sherman said Monday the deal would include the most extensive monitoring the United States has ever negotiated with any country. Sherman also said the pact would give new protection to Israel by increasing the length of time that Tehran would have to develop a nuclear weapon. The United States and Japan plan to expand their military cooperation under new guidelines that will allow Tokyo to project its power on a global scale. U.S. Defense Secretary of State John Kerry and Defense Secretary Ashton Carter discussed the guidelines with their Japanese counterparts on Monday in New York. Kerry said the move represents an historic transition in the relationship between the two countries. A senior U.S. defense official said the guidelines loosen the restrictions on what the Japanese military can do. He said they would allow Japan to shoot down missiles heading for U.S. territory, even if Japan itself was not under attack. Kenya's government has ordered the closure of the massive Dadaab refugee camps in the northeastern part of the country due to concerns about a security threat from the mostly Somali population. As VOA's Gabe Josla reports from the ground in Dadaab, refugees have mixed feelings about leaving a place that they have called home for more than 20 years.
More than 350,000 people, most of them Somali, call the sprawling Dadaab refugee camps home. Bilado Hassan came here from Mogadishu in 1992, one of the early arrivals fleeing violence at home.
At first, I was hopeful that I would go back home, but after about a year or two, the fighting got worse. There was no change, and so I got resigned to living here and accepted that I would live here.
But even long-standing refugees may soon get the boot. After the April 2nd terrorist attack on Garissa University killed 148 people, the government ordered Dadaab closed within 3 months because of fears the camps are harboring terrorist cells. The UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, already has a voluntary repatriation program, sending residents back to places in Somalia deemed safe. Seeing few opportunities for work and education in Somalia, refugees are understandably reluctant to pull up their roots in Dadaab, but many feel they have no other choice. Gabe Joslow, VOA News, Dadaab, Kenya.
And just before we go, Sudan's president, Omar al-Bashir, has won another term in office with 94% of the vote in an election boycotted by the opposition. Sudanese election officials announced the results on Monday from 4 days of voting earlier this month that had been widely expected to extend the presidency of Mr. Bashir, who has been in power since 1989. Well, that's a roundup of the latest world news on International Edition. I'm Michael Lippin.
I'm Jim Stevenson with business news from the Voice of America. U.S. stocks ended down Monday, led by losses in biotech shares after disappointing news from several companies, including Amgen. The Nasdaq Biotech Index sank 4.1%. That was its biggest daily percentage loss since March 25th, while the S&P Healthcare Index was down 1.8%, the biggest drag on the benchmark being Amgen. Its shares led the S&P 500's decline, dropping 3.3%, after U.S. regulators said Amgen's skin cancer immunotherapy cannot be considered for an accelerated review at this time. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 42 points to close at 18,037, the S&P 500 losing nearly 9 points to sit at 2108, and the Nasdaq Composite shed 31 points to finish at 50,060. The next challenge for financial markets and policymakers may not be deflation, but the remarkable surge in oil prices from the 6-year low touched in January. Since then, Brent crude futures have risen 45%. If that is sustained or even increased throughout this year, inflation next year could rise significantly. That poses some questions for policymakers largely committed to ultra-loose policy. No fewer than 27 central banks around the world have eased monetary policy to some extent this year in a battle against deflation, showing growth or both. Those measures have ranged from interest rate cuts to bond-buying quantitative easing programs. All have been in response to the fall in inflation rates and inflation expectations driven by the 60% collapse in oil prices over the latter part of last year. Investors' bets on the timing of the first interest rate increase from the U.S. Federal Reserve were pushed back to late this year, maybe even 2016. That's business news. With all of the fancy electronic gadgets and computers that we've come to rely on, power is king. If you don't have it, your stuff just doesn't work. Fortunately, if you're into photography, picture this. There's a new self-powered camera. David Byrd brings the story into focus on today's edition of Now. First, we head into the American Cafe with Ira Melman, who tells us that seniors are now learning from kids. It's a bit of a role reversal. That's coming up next.
I'm Ira Melman in the American Cafe. In a typical classroom setting, older people are teaching younger ones. But when it comes to learning about high-tech devices and internet navigation, the situation can easily be reversed. That is what's happening in Columbia, Maryland, where a free workshop offers seniors technology lessons taught by teenagers, even younger instructors who've grown up in the digital age. Faiza Al-Masri reports on what happens when seniors catch up with the younger generation in technology. Faith Lapidus narrates.
When Myra Stafford signed up for this workshop, she had one goal in mind. The 73-year-old wanted to learn how to use her iPad.
My daughter gave it to me, and she's been long waiting for me to use it.
Her daughter won't have to wait too long because Stafford is learning fast.
I am more confident today than I was before. Today I have more hands-on. Working with young people makes it wonderful because that's all they know. And they didn't make me feel that I was old or dumb.
11-year-old Zion Perkins is Stafford's teacher.
You have to be really, really patient, you know, because some of them might not know as well as others, so you have to be really patient.
Center Director Merity McCaig added the senior tech workshop last year after receiving a donation of several iPads from a local community organization. About 100 seniors have signed up for the classes since then.
As people are aging, their worlds get a little smaller. Some of them can no longer drive. Some of them don't get out to make long trips to see their relatives. And it brings them back out into Facebook and to Skype. And just to be able to communicate, they can do everything from ordering things from Amazon now to ordering groceries or meals.
Teaching seniors about technology also benefits the economy, says career and retirement expert Carrie Hannon.
You have a huge growing population over 60 that's just expanding and offers an incredible opportunity to buy online, to research products that they want to buy, maybe not online, but they research them online. About a third of internet users in general are over 50. As seniors get more excited about using the technology, they're going into the marketplace and buying it. So that's a boom for the economy right there.
As people live longer, retirees may consider getting back into the workforce. And the internet, Hannon says, is a valuable resource that helps them do that.
It is absolutely critical if you're looking for a job in today's market and you're over the age of 50, you absolutely have to be up to speed to technology. There are no excuses. A paper resume is no longer the big thing today. You need to have an online resume. You need to have your LinkedIn presence. And that's how you're going to network. That's how you're going to find jobs today.
That's Carlton Reed Calloway's goal.
When I was retiring in 1995, the computer world was coming in, and I was going out. So I didn't think that it was necessary for me to learn how to use a computer. You know, I was ready just to leave, to get out of it.
Now, as he starts his second career as an actor, it's a necessity.
You have to go online for job interviews. You have to go online to fill out applications. And everything is done online now. And if you don't know how to go online to do these things, I mean, so I had to get in touch with the new world.
17-year-old workshop instructor Madison Lamb showed him how. She's getting something from the class, too.
I think I've learned a lot and how to connect with people and work with, because I'm usually a shy person, so I'm not really good at, like, connecting with others besides my family and friends, so I've learned to be more outgoing.
The benefits for the young teachers go beyond building social skills, says Sapphire Windley with the Youth and Teen Center, which runs the program.
I find in this day and age, our young people, they're trying to explore and find out how do they add value to life, just trying to find their way. So this is something where they're needed and their skill set is valued and it gives them purpose.
For writer Faiza El-Masri, I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
I'm Ira Melman in the American Cafe. Join us every day on air, online, and podcast at voanews.com and many podcast platforms.
Hi, everyone. I'm David Byrd, and here's what's happening now. Have you ever been on vacation or at a family gathering and wanted to take a digital photo, only to discover that your camera was out of power? By the time you change the batteries, that magic moment is gone. Some scientists here in the United States have come up with a way to solve that problem, a self-powered camera. The prototype device takes an image each second in a well-lighted environment. It can shoot indefinitely. Professor Sri Nayar leads the team at Columbia University in New York.
So what we've designed here is an image sensor with pixels with this new design that can not only capture pictures but also generate power from the pixels in order to capture the images themselves. And that leads us to a fully self-powered image sensor.
It turns out the image sensor inside a digital camera converts the light into information that can be saved on the smart card. In modern camera diodes, there are tiny devices inside each pixel of the image sensor that measure the amount of light that hits it. Professor Nayar says that the process is very similar to the way a photovoltaic cell turns solar radiation into electricity. So his team found a way to harness that energy.
But it turns out that exactly the same photodiode is also used in solar cells, which are used in solar panels to harvest energy from light, except that they're being used in a slightly different circuit. So our thinking was to redesign the pixel in the camera so that it can serve both purposes.
Professor Nayar and his team used off-the-shelf materials to make an image sensor of 30 by 40 pixels. Definitely not the 12 megapixels you'll get in your camera, but it is the lowest resolution needed for a human face to be recognized. The image sensor switches between capturing the image and harvesting the power, and the pixels are used to both record and read the image and then to capture the energy and charge the sensor's power supply. Professor Nayar says that a well-lighted indoor room produces enough energy to power the camera and to recharge the system.
So if it's a well-lit indoor scene, that is sufficient light energy coming into the camera to not only capture images, but also to generate the power needed to capture the images. And therefore, what that means is that you can produce video indefinitely using this kind of a sensor. That is, without a battery, it can just keep running, producing visual content.
A typical indoor room produces about 300 lux. A lux is equal to 1 lumen per square meter. Outdoor light can produce as much as 10,000 lux of power, more than enough to power this camera. But there's a drawback. The Columbia model is bulky and costs several thousand dollars to build. Not the kind of camera you would want to carry on a vacation. But Professor Nayar says that in commercial production, his design could shrink and the cost would drop to levels comparable to a conventional chip that's found in your cell phone or in your computer.
The board that we have at the moment is very large because it is homegrown and we've put the pixels one at a time and we're using these large photodiodes in there. But what we've done is a calculation that shows that you can take the same design and make a compact image sensor chip with it. Of course, that chip would be able to capture less light and therefore harvest less energy because it's smaller. But it turns out that when you make it a chip, it also consumes less power.
A smaller version of the chip would enable cameras, such as security cameras, to run without power. Nair says that his ultimate hope is that the image sensor can be improved to serve as a power source when it's not capturing images. So maybe in a few years, you won't have to worry about changing those batteries. So what's your opinion? Let us know your thoughts on this story or anything you hear on our program by logging on to our Facebook page, VOA Asia. And remember, you can always email your questions or comments to voaasia@voanews.com. And that's what's happening now. Until next time, I'm David Byrd.
We've all heard some funny ringtones, like a duck call. A duck call ringtone happened to help a Louisiana firefighter rescue six real ducklings from a storm drain. A spokesman of the St. Tammany Fire District says even with that realistic quacking sound coming from his cell phone, it took firefighter Cody Necht about 90 minutes to catch the first of four baby mallards in the southeast Louisiana community of Slidell. All the ducklings were reunited with their mother. Time for sports on the Voice of America. I'm Jim Stevenson. Richie Ramsey has been named the Hilton European Tour Golfer of the Month for March after he claimed the third title of his career at the Trophy Hassan II tournament. The 31-year-old held on for a narrow one-stroke victory after he started the final day in a three-way tie. Well, the debate was pretty intense for the panel that was meeting at Hilton's landmark Waldorf Astoria Hotel in Edinburgh to hand out the award. Ramsey slipped past two of his competitors to take the honor, and Richie Ramsey speaks with Nick Dye.
Yeah, it's a good thing to have. Just touches off everything nicely. And like I say, it was a little bit of a slow start to the year, but I think, you know, a lot of people that I've spoken to said the way that I handled myself in Morocco, especially with the blip on eight, was really good, and obviously that resonated with people out there, and I'm very grateful that they voted and I managed to come out top.
Presumably a win like that gives enormous confidence, as well as the other things like money and world ranking points, but you kick on as a result with a bit of luck.
Yeah, I think you just try and take that and feed off the confidence you get from it. You know, golf's a really tough game, and the mental side is far and away the hardest thing to deal with. But, you know, those little things, you try and take that, put that confidence in the bank and try and use that when you're out in places like this, when things are a little tougher, and you just remember, you know, you played really well a few weeks ago, so just, you know, hang in there, and then that's what I did last week and had a great weekend and push right up the leaderboard. So, yeah, you've got to feed off things like this.
Golfer Richie Ramsey speaking with Nick Dye. The National Basketball Association playoffs are in full swing. The Grizzlies and the Bulls are heading into their games a short time from now in complete control of their respective series. They need just one more victory to advance to the next round. But what could happen? All you have to do is ask the Cleveland Cavaliers. The Cavs completed a sweep of the Boston Celtics on Sunday, but they lost Kevin Love to an injury. They might be without J.R. Smith when their second round series begins after he was ejected for hitting an opponent. Not a good way to advance in the NBA playoffs. That's a look at sports. I'm Jim Stevenson.
Beatle Paul McCartney and his band on tour. You'd think after six decades of writing, singing, recording, and touring, he'd not be out on the road most of the time. Well, Paul says he'll never give up touring, singing for his fans. Kurt. McCartney just announced his first U.S. tour date of 2015. He'll be in the city of Philadelphia, his first show there since 2010. Paul McCartney and his band have been playing to sold-out concerts all over the world, including South and Central America, as well as Japan and South Korea. It's part of his Out There tour.
Tadaima!
James Paul McCartney, born in Liverpool, England in 1942, has been busy making music since he was a teenager. Of course, he's known as one of the founding members of the British rock band The Beatles. With them and on his own, McCartney is recognized as one of the most successful singer-songwriters, with 100 million album sales and 100 million singles sold. That's music on VOA Global. I'm Steve Norman.
Well, I'm probably going to get a few emails about this next story, one that we normally don't broach on the air, not from you, but from my editors. Entries, it appears, are piling up for a slogan contest being held this year by the North American Manure Expo. It's a trade show, a real trade show, that's now in its 13th year. It showcases the latest technology in manure handling, treatment, and application. It's being held in July in Chambersburg, Pennsylvania. Why they're holding it in July when it's really hot and steamy, I don't know. Maybe the winter might be a better time for it. An official event slogan has already been settled on. It's 2015 Manure Expo, Manure Than You Can Handle. Of course, that's going to be appearing on front of a T-shirt. Contestants, though, are vying to land a spot on the back of that T-shirt, which event organizers say will display 10 of their also ran entries. Riders of the 10 alternate slogans will get a free T-shirt. That's the very least they should get, I guess. Many entries predictably contain some vulgar substitute for the word manure, but we have 10 entries that are suitable for airing, we think. Manure Expo, where nobody stands behind their product. You provide the creek, we provide the paddle. Keep your friends close and your manure further. The future of what's left behind. Manure happens, parentheses, to be nutritious. And the list goes on. We won't continue that one, but an interesting story nonetheless. We're about ready to wrap up our program. Our engineer is Zahrat Abuzaid, always well-appointed in a lovely chapeau. Our director and managing editor, Diane Gao, wearing many hats today. I don't have a hat, but I'm ready to put one on as we say goodbye. I'm Jim Stevenson. Join us again tomorrow for VOA Global.